Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkin.
And this is Core Intuition. How is this working?
Okay, Manton. Well, last week we spoke to you. You were safely ensconced in a San Francisco hotel room. And as I understand it, you have put your faith in Apple Maps to take you even further along on your journey.
Wherever it'll take me. Yeah, I'm currently on the Oregon coast recording with not the best internet connection, but a really great view of the ocean. So I guess I'll take that for a little while. And actually, that's kind of the theme of this crazy road trip is I haven't been online that much. And I mean, I have days that I've scheduled to work and I have days that I've scheduled to not think about work at all. And I've found that I've just kind of unplugged. I haven't been posting to even app.net. I haven't been following, you know, app.net or Twitter or really even blogs. I've just been catching up here and there. And I hadn't planned on that. I had planned on staying connected and staying up to date with what's going on, what people are talking about. But I've found that it's not that bad just to kind of be offline most of the time. And then last night I did some work, so I was online for a couple hours and I caught up on some things. So I'm not completely unplugged, but it's been nice the days where I am offline to just, you know, I just don't really check my phone. It's been pretty nice.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I know, it's crazy.
Well, I'm glad we were able to get you on the line. I'm glad we were able to update you about some of the ongoing news in the Apple world. Some news we want to update our listeners to, of course, and they would have noticed it probably on the episode title, but this, Manton, is our 100th episode. So I'm glad that we were able to actually rope you in from the precipice of technological disconnection to have you take part. It would have been pretty sad if I was like, this is episode 100 and Manton couldn't make it.
That would be pretty, that wouldn't be good.
Yeah. Episode 100 with guest host, who would it be? who would play Manton in a Hollywood biopic?
Oh my gosh. I don't know.
That's something we're going to have to think about. Maybe our listeners can help us scout out the perfect Manton stand-in. You know, we never ended up making those Manton and Daniel puppets that we were planning on.
Oh, right.
years ago. You'd have to be one of our earliest listeners to get that reference, but a few of you out there, I'm sure, are chuckling about that. And we still need those puppets, by the way. So
puppets would be good. Maybe t-shirts would be a stepping stone to that.
Yeah. Well, Manton, speaking of news that you may not have picked up on, I just got this news. Well, I'm making it into news myself, but this morning as we recorded on Tuesday, I woke up and there was this long stream of a mix of complaints and celebrations over the exercising of the Amber Alert system in California. At least in California, maybe further than that. But a bunch of our friends, a bunch of our, you know, San Francisco Bay Area oriented friends, and I guess you would have gotten this if you had still been there a few days ago, you know, if this alert had been a few days ago, but they were alarmed to discover that Amber Alerts, which are a United States, government-sponsored system for getting out news alerts about abducted children, missing children, there was an Amber Alert that was dispatched over the cell phone networks to folks in California at like 11 p.m. at night. And I think it's one of those situations where, like things like hurricane warnings and tsunamis and flash floods and all this other stuff, by default, the Amber Alerts are enabled and they have the quality that they don't respect the do not disturb setting on your phone.
Right.
So if it's the middle of the night and you're snoozing away, and your local law enforcement, the way I understand it, local law enforcement or state law enforcement makes a request to FEMA, which is the National Emergency Administration, whatever, and they then have the power, I guess, through their relationships with the mobile networks, to send out geo-fenced alerts to our phones. And so this is why I didn't receive the Amber Alert, being on the East Coast of the U.S. It sounds like you didn't receive it, Manton, up on the West Coast, but up in Oregon.
Yep.
And a lot of the outrage, I use the outrage term somewhat lightly, but you know, it did come across as outrage from some people who were just like, why the hell are they interrupting me when this is something that's happening 500 miles away?
Yeah. Kids that are kidnapped can be quickly traveled, you know, a few hundred miles. Yeah. So I'm not sure that bothers me. Obviously, I didn't get one. I was already up in Oregon, like you said. Are people also saying that it should have respected the do not disturb? Or are people okay that being an emergency?
People are also saying it should respect the do not disturb. And my gut reaction was to say, what do you... It's a kid, you know? It's
right.
You do get disturbed. But then the more I think about it, the more it makes sense to me that actually the goal of an Amber Alert in particular is different from the goal of, say, a hurricane warning or a flash flood warning. Mm-hmm. The goal in those cases is to alert the recipient of their impending peril, right? Mm-hmm. Like you, Manton Reese, you better wake up and get moving because there's a flood coming at you right now.
Right.
Whereas if it's an Amber Alert and it wakes you up at 3 a.m, say, and you're like, oh, keep my eyes out for a Toyota... you know, Camry with Arizona plates.
Right.
It's not like you're going to pop out of bed and go downstairs and stand out in the dark in your neighborhood and look around.
Unless you're working all night at the fast food place or the gas station. And I mean,
in which case you would probably not have do not disturb.
True. Good point.
Set.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, this is tricky. I haven't thought about this because you're telling me this news. This is for the second week in a row, I'm getting all my news from you, which is really interesting. But I'm not sure how I feel about that. There's also funny side effects because, like, you remember that case last year of someone's at a concert, the orchestra or whatnot, and their alarm keeps going off, and they didn't realize it was them, and then the conductor has to stop. Do you remember this? You know, he has to stop and say, turn off your phone.
Because he was undereducated about the meaning of do not disturb, which actually literally means do not disturb for most things.
Except alarms and I'm imagining like all these people in this theater get the Amber Alert at the same time. And so it's just like this echo of, this cacophony, people's phones beeping and there's nothing they can do about it. So I don't know. That would be interesting.
Frankly, thinking about this a little bit, I really do think there should be some user. I think that somebody phrased it well on Twitter when they said there should be a setting distinction between emergency alerts and public service alerts. You know, one of them is you are being notified of an impending emergency that affects you, and the other is you're being enlisted as a good person to be part of our fabric of society to you know, join in the public service of keeping us safe and rescuing people who need it.
Right.
And it makes sense to me that we can't all be expected to be on call for public service at every moment of every day, right? We can't. It's in the system relies upon the goodwill of us leaving this great, brilliant feature of our phones enabled that allows us to be enlisted effortlessly. And most of us say, hey, if I'm, you know, sitting in my office in the middle of a, you know, working on a bug or something, and this alert comes in that could save a kid, sure, let it in. I'm going to leave that feature turned on. But then the flip side of this, of course, is if you don't give well-meaning, good people the ability to sort of like control the extent to which their service is expected to stretch, then they will just opt out of the service, right? So if you say to people, listen, this is important stuff. It's about saving kids. We're going to wake you up every time. You have no choice. Well, they do have the choice to turn off the alert still.
They do. There's a way to opt out of the... And does that apply, I guess, to all emergency alerts if they opt out? So they also won't be notified of the flash flood?
I can't remember, and I'm too lazy to open up my phone right now, but there is an option to turn... It may be separate for Amber, I think it's a separate system, you know, separate switch for Amber Alerts versus quote unquote, you know, emergency alerts, which is why that kind of distinction could also be made about how much it disturbs you, how much it respects your do not disturb status. But
I don't know. But at some point, you don't want a million preferences for this. People already don't understand the mute switch and the do not disturb. And if there's a third level of settings, I don't know. Where does it end? Like how many toggles do you need to control?
Well, we've
exactly?
already made it. It can be default. It can be simple by default, but complex through settings. And I know that there's reason not to do that in lots of situations. But for example, we do already have the precedent now of do not disturb being penetrable by, say, close loved ones. You can whitelist people, right?
VIP.
I think people are sort of I think it's an evolving situation, this whole do not disturb status. You know, I think most people these days know that if they're in the symphony and they set an alarm to go off at 3 p.m., it's going to go off, mm-hmm. right? Whether they have do not disturb. That was kind of like an early growing pain, people right. getting used to what it means. And then the bottom line is just, you know, have great defaults for this stuff that make it work for most people. But if people get annoyed with Amber Alerts and their choices are continue being annoyed by it or turn it off completely, they're going to turn it off completely. So if you look at it from that perspective, if you want to maximize the odds that as many people will continue to, you know, sort of volunteer for as part of this service. And I think they'll do that. I think most of the people who were annoyed by this will still do that. I also think, like, for instance, they could have like a do not, I think they could have a class of notification that is that does not penetrate, do not disturb, but is a bit more annoying when you finally do shift your attention to your phone. So currently, like, if I get a text message in the middle of the night from somebody who's not on the whitelist, then I wake up and I look at my phone and it maybe has like a little note there, you got a text message. But then as soon as I unlock my phone, that thing's gone.
Right.
Right.
Maybe pop it back up or put it in red.
Yeah, it could say, no, seriously, this is a serious message. Right. So the first thing when these people wake up and become actually enlistable for public service, they have to kind of like acknowledge, oh, there's something serious that happened while I was sleeping. I think that would be a great compromise.
Yeah, I could see that. I'm personally not bothered by this. Like, I'm certainly not outraged because, again, okay, you inconvenience a couple million people, but then you save some kids somehow. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
sorry, million people, but you know, you got a text, and it's really not that big of a deal. You're not that annoyed in the big scheme of things compared to the mom or dad who is frantically trying to find their kid. But
but how does that scale, and how many kids could be saved through this, and then at what point would that nuisance be such that you'd lose the goodwill and good graces of those people?
And that's the thing also, is it has to really be an emergency. It has to really, if you're getting these every day, people will turn them off. It has to really matter. And maybe the 500 mile thing, maybe that was one of the big problems. Maybe it should have been a smaller radius at first. And then not in the middle of the night notified, you know, a larger area. I don't know. I'm also, not only am I hearing about this for the first time, I'm actually kind of experienced this technology for the first time, because actually up until this trip, I've never gotten one of these. I don't know if there's just something about Austin or Texas where the cell networks are not ready for these emergency alerts, or nothing bad happens in my
probably outlawed it. Texas probably doesn't think it's too liberal.
Yeah.
It's like, you know what?
You can carry guns, but you can't get a text on your cell phone.
You should be running your own privately funded Amber Alert system.
I'm going to blame our governor somehow. I shouldn't get too political on the show. So on this trip, I got one of these. So I think we were in New Mexico and there was a storm. We passed through a storm and, you know, we checked into our hotel and it starts raining. I think maybe there's hail. It was like a flash flood thing. And I got one of these emergency alerts on my phone. And at first I was like, I'd never gotten one of these before. At first I was like, what app is sending me this push notification? Like, how is this working? Is it like a weather app that I installed? Like, and no, it was of course this emergency system, but I had never actually experienced it before. And it was pretty cool. I mean, we were kind of, you know, high ground, safe. It wasn't really affecting us, but the system actually kind of worked, and that was, I don't know, I liked it. It was yeah. It was neat to see that actually worked, because I had never experienced it.
Right. It's a transformation in the ability to actually, you know, I mean, the old TV-based emergency broadcast system, the TV and radio that does the three beeps and all that, mm-hmm. that was obviously a step up from
right.
This is just, it's a beautiful technology if it works to actually effectively, you know, save people's lives or improve their quality of life dramatically. And yeah, I've gotten several of these. Some people have been annoyed with the weather ones because they feel they come too aggressively. In my experience, true, the weather alerts I've gotten have been usually not like immediate, you know, threat to me, but they were close. And, you know, there were times when, you know, like I got one of those emergency alerts shortly before our neighborhood lost about 100 trees to mm-hmm. freak. Microburst storm.
Yeah.
So sometimes they really work. And the folks like you, Manton, who haven't really experienced them, you probably, you know, so you didn't know that there were these alerts at all, probably. And then you didn't know that there was this distinction between like amber alerts and emergency alerts. Right. There's also, so the gist of it is those two alerts can be disabled. So if you're annoyed by either of those, you mm-hmm. can disable them
separately.
And then, yeah, separately. Mm-hmm. There's one alert that your phone can send you in the United States that you have no choice about.
Zombie attack.
Well, it may be a zombie attack that requires this force, but a lot of people don't know about this. There is the third class, at least, of emergency broadcast, which is message from the president.
Really?
I'm not joking. The deal is that this very system is also configured so that the president of the United States is equipped, if necessary, to send a message to every mobile phone, you know, that has the service.
Wow.
And you can't disable that.
Right.
That's cool. Has me thinking, if I were trying to cause some kind of havoc mm-hmm. in the U.S., let's just say I hope that message from the president system is double, triple, quadruple security protected.
Right.
Because imagine if you were a bad guy mm-hmm. and you wanted to, like, you could do some major War of the Worlds type panic inducement, you know? What if you yeah. said message from the president, you know, the left, California has fallen into the sea, right?
Right.
Everybody must take off all their clothes and run around in the street.
Yeah, that's wild. I had no idea, and that's cool though. I mean, if there's
yeah,
like I imagine like something bad is happening, or like there's some, I don't know, somebody else takes over the media and the television, and like the president is, you know, he's at yep. an undisclosed location, and he's the only one safe, and he can send out a message saying, you know, here's the truth. This is what's happening in your yeah. government.
The difference is, Manton, you and I are commie pinko liberals who right. don't mind this level of intrusion into our private security.
Right.
I can easily see other people being very disturbed by the fact that they have a direct line from the president that cannot mm-hmm. be disabled.
Right.
I don't have much sympathy. But you know, I'm of the mindset that even if it's the, you know, the president, even if the president is of an opposite political persuasion to me, say,
yeah,
I don't mind the president of the United States having the ability to send me a message
if it's an emergency. Yeah, but if it's like retweet this, so call your senators to get this bill passed, then that's not right.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is fascinating. That when you said Amber Alert, I mean, the like I said, we don't have the phone thing, but we do have on the side of the highway, you know, all these, you know, billboard, you know, electronic billboard things, and that's where all our Amber Alert stuff pretty much seems to go. So you're driving down the highway and you see this stuff pretty often, but I've never experienced it on my phone. So this is interesting.
Yeah, I'm surprised it's not working. I don't know what it is. It's probably some Texas thing. Like, you know, yeah. Texas is they do their own thing sometimes. Sometimes they're like, you know what, government, we don't want your hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. We don't appreciate your attempts to make our quality. I'm sorry. Anyway.
Yeah, we should stop Wirehead.
Core political controversy. This is all in celebration of our 100th episode, folks, where we are a little bit slap happy, a little bit travel weary.
Yeah, I'm still on vacation.
You're still on vacation. Yeah, you're allowed to break it down a little.
Okay, this week we are sponsored again by Windows Azure Mobile Services. So Windows Azure Mobile Services has a few different features that are targeted at iOS developers. They've got database in the cloud. That's probably the most important thing that people are going to want to use. You can have model objects in your iOS app, sync them up to the cloud, pull them back. It's dynamic. You don't need to set up a schema or define a lot of stuff in advance, and works really well. They also have push notifications, so you can trigger those from Azure. They have authentication with Twitter and Facebook, so if you want to have authentication in your app and allow people to log in, you can hook into that pretty easily. And basically, it's just everything in one place. You don't need to use a lot of different services. They offer a lot for iOS developers right there. And it's easy to integrate. You can download an Xcode project and customize it. And it's free to get up and running. So it's a great service. And thanks for sponsoring.
Yeah, you know, Manton, one of the great things about Windows Azure Mobile Services, it strikes me how these great ideas for apps that have these infrastructural requirements, in the old days, you might have just said, oh, boy, I could do the iOS app or I could do the Mac app, whatever, but I can't go build this entire back end. And right. That's what makes Windows Azure Mobile Services such a great resource for folks, is because it lets you jumpstart that. And, you know, we've had the opportunity to talk a bit about it here on the show during these sponsorship breaks, but I wanted to mention to our listeners that there have been a couple other pertinent podcast episodes. Episode 90 of the iDeveloper podcast is all about Azure services. So if your interest is piqued by this and you want to go learn a bit more about that, we'll have a link to that in our show notes. And there was also an appearance by our friend Josh Twist from Microsoft on the NS Brief interview podcast with Saul Mora. So there's a couple good opportunities there to learn more about Azure services in a little bit of a more drawn out format.
Yeah, definitely. I was on this trip, I was catching up on podcasts. I just recently listened to the NS Brief episode where he interviews Josh, and he goes into a couple things like the extensibility via JavaScript. So you can hook in to various points in the process, like when you're saving a record to the database, you want to hook in and say right before it's created, I want to modify the record, or right after I want to send something or post-process something. He goes into a little bit of that, which is a really neat feature, I think, of mobile services. And so, yeah, check out those podcasts. We will link them in the show notes to that specific episode if you want to hear more about it. So thanks again for sponsoring Microsoft. And if everyone wants to check out more, go to www.windowsazure.com/iOS.
All right, folks. Well, as you know, we love to get questions. We don't always get to them super quickly, but we love having a collection of questions to answer and try to give us something to talk about. And this week we have a question from Matt Christensen via app.net. He asks, as someone wanting to get into development in my very rare free time, I'm overloaded by documentation. Can you guys talk on the show about when to go to the documentation and how you guys use it? So Manton, I think I get sort of the gist of what he's saying is, well, here's the problem. We have this great, I think we're very privileged as Apple platform developers to have, you know, sometimes there's lots to complain about with the documentation, but there's a whole heck of a lot of it. And in general, I think Apple documentation is very good, covers lots of the bases of things you need to know about the various technologies. But if you just go to like developer.apple.com and it's not in the midst of a week-long shutdown, yeah, then you can really kind of get overwhelmed. I can relate to that. There's, you know, even if you zero in on like a subject that you're interested in, it can be like, oh, do I want the tech notes or the sample code or the conceptual overview or the, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, for instance, you can't go to Apple and say, I'm just going to go read all the documentation. I guess right. You could, but I certainly never have. How about you?
I've certainly never done that. Right now, the way I'm using it is a lot with the pre-release stuff. And so that actually was the only thing that really affected me when the dev portal was down, is I hadn't downloaded the, you know, iOS 7 documentation, the Mavericks documentation locally yet. And so I actually couldn't read any of those APIs. Minor inconvenience, but definitely, you know, in Xcode, there's an option to download all that stuff locally. If you care about it, you should do that just so you have a local copy in case you're offline. Maybe you're on a big road trip, you're in the middle of nowhere, and you want access to those. So that a lot of what I have been doing lately is that, reading those and reading the what's new. That's a great starting point. Like if you're thinking, oh, I'm going to require iOS 7 or even iOS 6, and you want to know specifically what's the new stuff that you should take advantage of and think about how it fits into your app, the what's new and the release notes are good places to start. Just for getting started, just in a bigger picture, like I'm new to the platform, they actually have some really good, like, getting started guides, and maybe we can find a couple and link to them. But they're a lot better now about, if you click in the right place, they kind of walk you through, like, here's what you need. You need to set up your Xcode thing. Here's the overview of, you know, AppKit or UIKit, or here's a link to certain parts of the human interface guidelines. So they're doing a really good job lately of pulling that stuff together, so it's not quite so overwhelming as just here's a list of every API.
Yeah. Well, the main thing about this, keep in mind with reference, is it really is intended to be used that way. So
right.
All those documents that are like, here is every class in every framework and every method on every class in every framework, you can't, I mean, if you're bored, I guess, go ahead, read through that. But, you know, it's intended to be stuff you get to when you're like, you're programming and you're like, man, it would really be convenient if there were a method on NS window or UI window, UI, you know, you don't even use UI windows much, but UI view that did this. And then you like, let me just search the reference. Oh, look at that. There is something like that.
Right.
You read the finer points of it. You say, oh, okay, well, turns out you can pass nil for this argument and it does something meaningful still. That's the way I mostly use the documentation. Mm-hmm. But I'm also a big fan. I make a point when, for example, Mavericks came out, you know, the pre-releases, when the iOS releases come out, I make a point of adding to my OmniFocus to-do list, read all of the release notes.
Yes.
And this is the what's new stuff you're alluding to, I think.
Yep.
And it's important not just to orient yourself to what's new, obviously, but there are often little gems of information in there that, for whatever reason, you know, a fault of documentation probably, for whatever reason, never end up in the proper documentation. So actually, I even go back to the what's new, the release notes, years later sometimes. You know, we were joking a few episodes back, Manton, that I was just finally getting into some of the 10.6 stuff. You know, full screen modes and all this other stuff that's like, or versions and autosave. And some of that stuff, I was looking and looking in the documentation. I was like, what do they expect you to do with this? And then it takes sometimes going back to that 10.6 release notes for AppKit. And they'll have like, because that stuff's written by, my memory is that stuff's written by engineers, which is not to fault the dedicated documentation authors at all, because they do a much better job than engineers at the task in general. But that developer-written release notes stuff is sometimes where you get, like, you know, the stuff that really puts it into perspective for us. Like, note, this is not something you would ever do when dismissing a UI panel. You know, this is not meant for that. And then for whatever reason, that might not end up getting into the documentation. And that's sort of a bug. But then sometimes this is where you find the magic, the real – or sometimes there'll be little stuff in there like – constants that were defined in the header files, never documented except in release notes. You're like, oh, that's what that means.
Yeah, I agree. You need a mix of that, you know, something written by the person who actually wrote the API and then people who, you know, worked with those developers to sort of come up with more formal documentation, because you get different things out of each one of those. And that's, you know, it reminds me of why I wish Apple engineers like blogged more or were allowed to, because I think they probably have a lot to share. I mean, some guy who wrote some obscure AppKit API probably could write really interesting things about it that would actually help us third-party developers understand the API or understand sort of the implementation details that are not obvious at all from looking at the headers. So I wish we had a little more of that, but the formal documentation is certainly getting a lot better. It's really good right now, actually. Day-to-day, how do you use the documentation? Because I mean, most of the time for me, I'm coding and I forget something. A lot of times I just go to the header real quickly. Yep. And because that, it seems like it's the, it has the most stripped away. It's just, just the method names, the parameters, it's the basic stuff. And it, also if you're looking up like a protocol or some delegate method you've forgotten, you can quickly kind of copy and paste that stuff and put it in. And then if that isn't good enough, I'll click over to the real documentation. I forget the keyboard shortcuts, but after you've done this enough, you hold down command and click or whatever it is. And you can kind of quickly jump to the header or then jump to the little pop-up documentation or the full documentation.
Yeah, I think I go something like this. I think I go like option click or whatever on the symbol. I think brings up the little pop-up, dictionary lookup style thing. That's terse and sometimes doesn't have enough. Often then I will go like command double click, I think, is to go to the header. Mm-hmm. And if you get lucky, then information you need is there. Then I jump into, for all of its warts, the documentation viewer is something I still use. And try to just do a keyword search on what I'm looking for, get in there, look around. Sometimes you have to try to do like take the search term and just go to like developer apple.com and like search everything. And sometimes here's a little funny trick that usually doesn't apply, but sometimes, especially if you're like me and Manton, like Manton and I, some would say, you still have some like old legacy stuff you're working on. Manton, you can probably relate to this real well because you've even still done some Carbon stuff, I think. Mm-hmm. There's this whole class of documentation that Apple calls legacy, I think. And it's all indexed at apple.com, but it's completely omitted from search results unless you go in and like make a special choice to search legacy documents. And what's interesting about that, you can go back and you can search like how to program for the ADB interface on a Mac Plus or something. Not that you should, but there's a lot, to Apple's credit, they have written a lot of documentation over the years, and a whole heck of a lot of it is still available one way or the other. And finally, if all else fails, I will sometimes go to Google. Sure. Because sometimes these terms are not defined anywhere except, where the like three other people in the world questioned it and like came to a conclusion about it that maybe aren't even at Apple. But also sometimes these constants are parts of, Apple's open source stuff, which is, in my experience, best indexed by Google itself. And so you'll put in some obscure, security framework error constant or something, and it'll pop up in Google's open source rendition of Darwin. So I guess that's about it. That's the that's the best I know for documentation. I know a bunch of folks use these improved documentation viewers.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask you if you had tried. A while back, I used one of them. I've forgotten the name now. And every once in a while, a new one pops up, and I mean to try it because those often do a better job of having structured data that is really fast to search and kind of drill down and look up things. Yeah. Whereas Apple's often is, we have a bunch of HTML pages. And even if it's in a quote-unquote native viewer, it still feels like a bunch of HTML pages. It doesn't feel like a integrated sort of structured database of methods and APIs.
I think they have a long way to go with Apple's documentation viewer, but I think what keeps me using it is similar to what keeps me using Xcode. It's got all of its warts. It's got its frustrations. It's got its completely boneheaded behaviors, but it's the one that is actually literally tied to everything else Apple does. Right. So it's like, I should probably give a good look to some of these other solutions if they manage to tie in as well as Apple does. But, for example, if I go get one of these other services, how well is it going to be? It's not going to probably be able to automatically download the latest Mavericks documentation for me. Somebody can shout at me and prove me wrong about that if it's true. And if there is a documentation viewer out there that does everything, let's put it this way. Even if it did quote unquote everything, it's probably not going to pop up when I command double click on a term in the Xcode editor. So right. It's all that integration really adds up to something that's hard to give up just for, you know, an improved UI in other respects.
Right. Well, thanks for the question, Matt. And I think that's a show this week.
Yeah, Matt, and I'll let you get back to your relaxation and complete ignorance of the world, the important world of technological firestorms. I'll let you know if there are any other alerts you should be receiving on your phone.
Please just forward those emergency alerts as a text message to my phone at normal hours.
Yeah. All right. Well, take care, and I'll chat with you again soon.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.